Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, we hear a segment of another What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. We close the show, as always, with an American story. We also hear some news about the world's wildlife. But first, Ashley Thompson and I take you to a few American cities to learn how they celebrate the holiday season.
In New York City, one of the best-known holiday attractions is Rockefeller Center's Christmas tree in Manhattan. The tree is lit during a public ceremony in late November. The city has displayed a large Christmas tree here since 1933. This year's tree is 23 meters tall and covered with 50,000 lights. A Swarovski crystal sits on top. Ornate window displays are another New York Christmas tradition. Large department stores along the famous shopping area of Fifth Avenue create imaginative displays during the holiday season. Stores choose different themes every year. This year, for example, Saks Fifth Avenue's windows celebrate the 80th anniversary of the Disney film Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. Another famed department store, Bergdorf Goodman, celebrates New York's diverse museums and cultural sites, such as the Philharmonic and the New York Historical Society. The Fifth Avenue windows are so popular that police use long ropes to set up controlled lines for the window viewing.
Miracle on 34th Street is a well-known and beloved American Christmas movie. And there is actually a real Miracle on 34th Street in Baltimore, Maryland. Every year, Baltimore residents along a block of 34th Street put up an almost blindingly bright display of Christmas lights and decorations. Thousands of people visit the block to see the bright and colorful display of Christmas cheer, now in its 71st year. The event opened with an official lighting ceremony on November 25th and will continue through the holidays.
Every December, City Park in New Orleans, Louisiana, becomes a winter wonderland. It features more than 10 hectares of light displays, its famous old oak trees wrapped in thousands of twinkling lights. More than 160,000 people visit the Celebration in the Oaks each year. New Orleans also celebrates its French Creole connection each holiday season with Réveillon dinners. Réveillon comes from the French word for awakening. The 19th century French Creole tradition began as a large meal eaten after midnight mass on Christmas Eve. The Réveillon tradition is still alive in New Orleans' French Quarter. Restaurants there offer special Réveillon meals that include oysters and other seafood, meat, soup, dessert, and more.
The icy North Pole is said to be the home of Santa Claus. So it is no surprise that the small Alaskan town with the same name is home to the world's largest Santa statue. It stands in front of Santa Claus House, the center of the town's Christmas activities. While the town displays Christmas decorations all year round, it really comes alive in December. The North Pole Christmas in Ice Contest brings ice artists from around the world to the town of 2,000 people. Visitors can slide down frozen slides and work their way through complex ice mazes.
The central U.S. city of Indianapolis, Indiana, is famous for its yearly Indy 500 automobile race. During the winter holiday season, the world-famous racetrack fills up with more than 2 million Christmas lights, 500 light displays, and 40 holiday scenes. Visitors are permitted to drive their own cars on the speedway.
A traditional Mexican festival takes place in Los Angeles, California. The 9-day Las Posadas celebration is one of the city's oldest Christmas events. Las Posadas can be found on Olvera Street, considered the first street of the city. The celebration commemorates the story of Mary and Joseph traveling from Nazareth to Bethlehem to prepare for Jesus' birth. Celebrations are held nightly from December 16th through December 24th. The events include a candlelight parade, children clothed to look like shepherds, angels, and Mary and Joseph lead the march, followed by worshipers. The public can also join the parade or just watch from the side. The group sings songs in English and Spanish as they walk. Posada means inn or shelter in Spanish. During the parade, the marchers stop at stores along Olvera Street that pretend to be inns. They ask the business owners for shelter. The stores usually deny the request, often in song. Finally, one will say yes, and the marchers are admitted. Free hot drinks and sweetbread are served.
Many scenic railways around the country offer train rides that center on Santa Claus and Christmas. In Arizona, the Grand Canyon Railway brings to life the classic children's book Polar Express, written by Chris Van Allsburg. The train sets off from Williams, Arizona, and travels for 90 minutes until it arrives at Santa's Village, where Santa and his elves welcome the passengers. Santa and his helpers ride the train back to Williams with the passengers. Each child receives a small bell as a gift.
Does your city, town, or village do something special for the holiday season? We'd like to know. Comment on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
News about endangered species often worries people. But on December 5th, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, had some good news. In publishing its yearly Red List of Endangered Species, it noted some success for two kinds of New Zealand birds. The IUCN said the Okarito kiwi and the northern brown kiwi are now in less danger of disappearing from existence than in the past. The IUCN reports that New Zealand is reducing the populations of animals that kill and hunt the birds. The animals include stoats and cats. The number of Okarito kiwi has risen from 160 in 1995 to as many as 450 now, the IUCN said. It reported a rise in northern brown kiwi numbers also. The IUCN is made up of government and non-government experts. Its studies help guide conservation policies. The Red List identifies which local species are at risk of disappearing from Earth. Two species are new to the IUCN endangered list: the Irrawaddy dolphin and the finless porpoise travel along the coastlines of Southeast Asia. The Red List report says these sea animals get trapped in fishing nets and are harmed by other human activities as well. The use of gill nets is among the fishing methods harmful to these species. The nets are used on the Mekong River and in other major waterways. They hang across waterways and entrap everything in the path. Researchers have counted for the Red List about 91,500 of almost 1.9 million described species. Of these, 25,821 are threatened, 866 no longer exist, and 69 others no longer exist in the wild. The IUCN describes 11,783 species as vulnerable, 8,455 as endangered, and 5,583 as critically endangered. Australia's western ringtail possum has moved from vulnerable to critically endangered on the Red List. The IUCN said its population dropped by 80% over the past 10 years. The western ringtail possum was once widespread in peppermint and eucalyptus forests. Now the animal has only a few disconnected places to live. High temperatures, which sicken the species, are becoming increasingly common where it lives. The IUCN announced its findings in Tokyo. I'm Jill Robbins.
Next up, we listen to part of a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. Today's subject is Sidney Poitier. The movie star got his start in show business in 1949. And at 90 years old now, he is still working. Here, the Bahamian American talks about the first time he went to the movies.
I met these new kids, and they sort of embraced me. And they said to me, they said that they were going to a matinee, would I like to come? And I didn't want them to know. I didn't know what the word matinee meant. So I said, okay, sure, all right, you know, I want to be one of the group. So they went to this theater, but I didn't know I was going to see a movie. I had no idea. So they bought a ticket for me, and we went in, and we sat in this place. Well, the whole place was seats. The lights go down, and a curtain, big curtain thing opened up, and there was this big white frame. And suddenly, out of nowhere, came letters, big letters, words. I can barely read, so I just kind of waited to see what's going to happen with this lit-up screen. Then I saw people, and it shocked me. How did they get there? Then I saw cows, and I saw wagons, and I saw brown people wearing skins and feathers. I had no idea. That was my first movie.
Poitier did go to school on NASA for a year or two, but then at 12 and a half, he quit. His family was in desperate financial shape, and Sidney was tall enough to pass as an older teenager, so he got a job.
First, I went to work as a water boy working on construction. So I walked up and down the line where these guys were working, and I have this bucket and this dipper, and they would take a drink, and that was my job. But it didn't pay very much, and my folks really were in need. And the guy that I went to, he was like foreman. He gave me a pick and a shovel, and I was among the big guys. I stayed at that job, and then I worked in a warehouse where I had to take a 98-pound bag of rice or sugar or flour and stack them to the ceiling. We would lay the first foundation for it. Every bag of whatever would be put here until it covers the whole floor. And then we'll use that, each bag, as a step. And then we'll do another, and then another step, so that toward the end, I would have 98 pounds on my shoulder walking up these steps to the ceiling.
To hear the podcast in its entirety, go to the What It Takes section on our website. Now it's time for an American story. Here is part two of Benito Cereno by Herman Melville.
As Captain Delano came up in his whaleboat, he saw that the other ship needed scraping, tarring, and brushing. It looked old and decayed. He climbed up the side and came aboard. He was quickly surrounded by a crowd of black men. Captain Delano looked around for the man who commanded the ship. The Spanish captain stood a little way off, against the main mast. He was young-looking, richly dressed, but seemed troubled and tired with the spirit gone out of him. He looked unhappily toward his American visitor. At the Spanish captain's side stood a small black man with a rough face. Captain Delano struggled forward through the crowd, went up to the Spaniard, and greeted him. He offered to help him in any way he could. Captain Benito Cereno returned the American's greeting politely, but without warmth. Captain Delano pushed his way back through the crowd to the gangway. He told his men to go and bring back as much water as they could. Also bread, pumpkins, sugar, and a dozen of his private bottles of cider. The whaleboat pushed off. Left alone, Captain Delano again observed with fresh surprise the general disorder aboard the ship. Some of the men were fighting. There were no deck officers to discipline or control the violent ones, and everyone seemed to do as he pleased. Captain Delano could not fully understand how this could have happened. What could explain such a breakdown of order and responsibility? He asked Don Benito to give him the full story of his ship's misfortunes. Don Benito did not answer. He just kept looking at his American visitor as if he heard nothing. This angered Captain Delano, who suddenly turned away and walked forward to one of the Spanish seamen for his answer. But he had hardly gone 5 steps when Don Benito called him back. "It is now 190 days, Don Benito began, "that the ship sailed from Buenos Aires for Lima with a general cargo, pedigree, tea, and the like, and a number of Negroes, now not more than 150, as you see, but then numbering over 300 souls. The ship was officered and well manned, with several cabin passengers, some 50 Spaniards in all. Off Cape Horn we had heavy gales." Captain Sereno coughed suddenly and almost collapsed. He fell heavily against his body servant. "His mind wanders," said Babo. "He was thinking of the disease that followed the gales, my poor, poor master." "Be patient, senor. These attacks do not last long. Master will soon be himself." Don Benito recovered, and in a broken voice continued his story. "My ship was tossed about many days in storms off Cape Horn, and then there was an outbreak of scurvy. The disease carried off many whites and blacks. Most of my surviving seamen had become so sick that they could not handle the sails well. For days and nights we could not control the ship. It was blown northwestward. The wind suddenly left us in unknown waters with oppressive hot calms. Most of our water was gone, and we suffered terribly, especially after a deadly fever broke out among us. Whole families of blacks and many Spaniards, including every officer but myself, were killed by the disease." Don Benito paused. He looked down at the black man at his side. Babo seemed satisfied. The Spanish captain saw him take his hand from the knife hidden under his shirt. Captain Delano saw nothing. His mind was filled with the terrible tale he had just heard. Now he could understand why the other captain seemed so shaken. He took Don Benito's hand and promised to give him all the help possible. He would give him a large, permanent supply of water and some sails and equipment for sailing the ship. And he also promised to let Don Benito have 3 of his best seamen for temporary deck officers. In this way, the San Dominique could, without delay, start for Concepcion. There, the ship could be fixed and prepared for its voyage to Lima. Don Benito's face lighted up. He seemed excited by Captain Delano's generous offer. But Babo appeared troubled. "This excitement is bad for Master," Babo whispered, taking Don Benito's arm and with soothing words gently drawing him aside. When Don Benito returned, Captain Delano observed that his excitement was gone. Captain Delano decided to talk of other matters, but the Spanish captain showed no further interest. He answered Captain Delano's questions with sharp words, and suddenly, with an angry movement, he walked back to Babo. Captain Delano watched the two men whispering together in low voices. It made an ugly picture, which Captain Delano found so extremely unpleasant that he turned his face to the other side of the ship. Their actions made Delano suspicious of Captain Sereno. He began to wonder about him, his behavior, his coughing attacks, his weakness, his empty, wild looks. Was he really half mad, or a faker playing a part? One moment, Captain Delano had the worst suspicions of Don Benito, but the next, he felt guilty and ashamed of himself for having such doubts about the man. Presently, Don Benito moved back toward his guest, still supported by his servant. His pale face twitched. He seemed more nervous than usual, and there was a strange tone in his husky whisper as he spoke. "May I ask how many men you have on board, senor?" Captain Delano became uneasy, but answered, "About 25 all total." "And at present, senor, all on board?" "All on board," Captain Delano answered. "And will be tonight, senor?" At this last question, Captain Delano looked very seriously at Don Benito, who could not return the look, but dropped his eyes to the deck. Captain Delano could think of only one reason for such a question. But no, it was foolish to think that these weak and starving men could have any idea of seizing his ship. But still, he remained silent. "And will they be aboard tonight?" Again, the question from Don Benito. Captain Delano decided to answer truthfully. Some of his men had talked of going off on a fishing party about midnight, and he told Don Benito this. As he answered, Captain Delano again looked straight at Don Benito, but the Spanish captain refused to meet his eyes. Then, as before, he suddenly withdrew with his servant, and again the two men began whispering to each other in low voices. Captain Delano tried to push the worry from his mind, but what were those two strange men discussing?
That's all the time we have for today's show. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.